You're listening to Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. I'm Heidi Holton. Joining me in the studio as we continue this conversation about jobs and work, it's Aaron Brown from Minnesota Brown and Chuck Marone from Strong Towns. You know, so I switch the order every time.
Yeah.
Make it fair.
It works. I don't
top billing or I walk.
Now we're kind of talking about the future a bit here. And I think one of the big things, and we had talked in our first episode of Dig Deep, Chuck, you talked about how jobs, and in this last election, that was really the surprising point of what happened in terms of presidential politics.
Yeah, if you listen to President Obama, you listen to President Obama's supporters, you listen to the Hillary Clinton campaign, unemployment's down. I mean, we solved this problem. We've got lots of jobs. Everything's great. You know, unemployment is at lows we haven't seen since, you know, the 90s. And the reality on the ground, of course, is very, very different. The percentage of people in the workforce is at all-time lows. We have lots of people who are underemployed. And there's real problems out here. And I think that if there's a part of the Trump campaign that was the most real, it was that. It was tapping into the notion that there is a certain cognitive dissonance between, I'll use the derogatory terms and then you can correct me, Aaron, the urban liberal looking at the world around them and seeing an economy that seems to be functioning, not understanding the plight of the rural conservative, or you know, we can even take the liberal and conservative tags off, although I think they apply, and not really understanding how those rural economies work and are suffering and are failing to achieve things for people. And I think you can see this most clearly in the response. If you look at Democratic politicians at the national level, what you get a lot of is, we need job programs. We need retraining. We need education money. Basically, we need to take people who are now underemployed in rural areas and make them like urban liberals. You know, get them college educations and get them out there. I'm not suggesting that the Republican response is any better. The Republican response is, let's just keep driving up efficiency and productivity and make everything cheaper and globalize everything. And, you know, people will figure it out because they're smart and resourceful. That's not working either. But those two approaches, to me, were kind of embodied in the whole Trump conversation. And it really should be a wake-up call for us that this whole idea of jobs and just putting people to work is not working the way we're going about doing it.
The idea of the urban liberal, I won't even necessarily argue that much, in that it's clear, in Minnesota being a perfect example, because we have the one big metro area and then regional centers. And you can look at our state as a microcosm of the nation, almost 50-50 in the presidential totals between Clinton won the state, but not by much. And you can look at where the votes were, clear as day. Democratic support has centered around the metro areas and the regional centers, and Republican support is now very strong throughout the rural part of the state, whether it's agriculture or even on the Iron Range, where for the first time since Hoover, Trump carried Hibbing and several other range towns. I mean, Hoover was a long time ago. And so disappointing.
I was going to say, he keeps getting brought up and thrown in.
No, I'm not even saying bad things about Hoover. I'm just saying Hoover was a lifetime ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And the world has changed a few times over since. And nevertheless, the range voted DFL until just very recently. So, and I think what Chuck's talking about, the idea that the liberal party in the country wasn't speaking to the plight of the people who had been Democrats, who had been maybe not liberal, but had been very pro-worker, pro-union, and very economically liberal, I guess you'd say. They're willing to spend money on government, willing to accept a government role in making things fair. Those folks sailed on the Democrats, and they're now of the thinking that, you know, we don't have the work availability, we don't have job security. The thing is, whether it's underemployment or even full employment, the idea that you can't quite get ahead, that you can never quite save as much as you used to be able to save, that you're always at risk of losing everything. And I think that's much more pronounced in rural areas. That's, I think, the big rural-urban divide. I mean, there's culture, there's religion, there's politics, but I think the fact that in rural Minnesota, you're struggling a little bit more than you are if you're in the metro area or in a place where if you do get laid off, there's a legitimate chance you could get another job within a few months. That's, you know, if I get laid off, I don't know where I get a job right away. And so I think that's the big difference there. And we still have people voting liberal or conservative for various reasons, some of them cultural. But I think that's what changed in this last election. And that, I think, is an example of what's wrong in our economy. Because we have this big push. Jobs are moving to the metro areas. That's where the jobs are. And I think looking forward to the future of employment, we're coming up on a time when uninhibited, if we don't change anything or do anything, I think most of the employment available in the future is going to be in a metro area. And the land outside will be recreational or some kind of automated industrial, well, I won't say hellscape. It doesn't have to be a hellscape, but could be. It could be just a big industrialized thing where a couple people in a little technology hub push some buttons and the robots go plow the fields and haul the ore and run the trains. Actually, that's exactly the future predicted. I was talking to a Swedish reporter who came here to write about mining. Northern Sweden has a mining area very similar to ours and an economy very similar. And sure enough, the nationalists, the far-right nationalists in Sweden are concentrated in greater numbers in northern rural Sweden, just like they are, the far-right nationalists are found in rural areas here in Minnesota and the United States. And it's, he thinks just that. He said, well, I think you got your metro areas where most people live and work. You've got your recreational areas where it's expensive to live and mostly wealthy people can afford to live there. And then you've got your everywhere else. And it won't be very nice to live in those places, he said. And it won't be very nice to work in those places. But that's where all the resources are going to come from.
I used to think life was just down. If Joe got up, he pushed Jack to the ground. Then the cliche got to me. Love took hold. Now all I see is South Carolina, where the rocking chair sways. She dreams of a wraparound.
That is Aaron Brown talking about the divide of urban and rural and what that means for the future of our local economies. This is the Dig Deep podcast, our final on jobs, talking about the future of jobs now with Chuck Barone of Strong Towns. He has some ideas of his own.
Love took hold. Now all I see is South Carolina, where the rocking chair sways. She dreams of a wraparound porch and snapping peas all day. I used to laugh at the simple way. Now it's a new world I see. She's 5'5" with big brown eyes.
You're describing an economy of computer programmers and baristas. I mean, mm-hmm. It's like one or the other, right? Like choose a, mm-hmm. You're either going to be very well paid and well compensated and have a lot of options in front of you, or you're going to be a replaceable cog in the system. I'd like to throw out three kind of paths forward and get your reaction to them. Because the first one, I'm going to call the minimum wage, like raising the minimum wage. And that's been the standard response of the left to income inequality and low-paying jobs and the fact that people are getting left behind. The second one I would like to talk about is the universal minimum income, a universal basic income. The idea that, okay, if we are leaving people behind, how do we make sure that everybody's at a certain level? And then the third one is probably one you haven't thought about a lot, but it's the one that has kind of become an obsession to me. And that is, how do we, in a sense, slow down the velocity of our small town economies so that we're actually retaining more of that capital and having less of it leak out in the whole efficiency game. So maybe we can start with a minimum wage. To me, if you said, Chuck, minimum wage or universal basic income, I would say I would get rid of the minimum wage. And I'm very open to having a conversation about the universal basic income.
Well, and I come at this generally supportive of a minimum wage that at least approaches a living wage, because, you know, I think we can, sitting in our ivory perches, move some chess pieces around and say, oh, we got this figured out for all those poor SOBs who are underemployed or don't have much income. But right now we live in an economy that is the way it is, and minimum wage has a way of putting money directly into the pockets of people who need the money and who won't sit on the money or hoard the money, but will in fact expend it back into the economy in the form of economic activity and purchasing and local purchasing. So I'm supportive of minimum wage in that sense. Now, I hear what you're saying about universal basic income, because the premise, and I've been toying with universal basic income in some of my writing as well, it's actually got a lot of support from different political philosophies. You've got some conservatives, libertarian types, not libertarians, I shouldn't say, but conservative, certainly business-oriented types who know that, you know, most of these big corporations know that they can't employ people like they used to. The boss knows. We got machines that do it now, and we have to do it this way for our stockholders, for future and the survivability of our company. We know we can't employ people. Mark Cuban talks about this a lot. We just can't employ people at the levels that the country needs. So they support universal basic income. I think, and ultimately for a selfish reason, but one that makes sense, is they would rather not have their heads cut off in a riot. And Bill Gates has talked about this too, is that if we don't take care of people, we know what happens in history when you have a vast proletariat who isn't being served by either party, by any government, who ultimately feels totally on their own, totally desperate, and it's not good for people.
What happens? You get the election of Donald Trump.
Well, that's not even that's
it's like
just
a preview of coming
that's
attractions.
Just a warm up. That's
right,
not even the real problem.
No, it totally.
That's just a reaction. I'm just going to say, I know I'm the liberal, but I'm going to suggest very gently that it's possible that Trump presidency does not fix all the problems.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, you say you support the minimum wage, and I find this very interesting because, to me, the minimum wage is like the automation driver, right? Like we've probably all been to a McDonald's now where you don't have to actually go to the counter to order. You can just put your thing in. And you look at like the McDonald's worker as being like the hyper-efficient replacement of the waitress that mm-hmm. used to come to your table and actually give you service. Now, you know, you have this mm-hmm. thing that we've now taken and automated even more. The minimum wage kind of drives that.
I think, you know, speaking as having worked with Democrats and having known people who have even, you know, carried bills trying to increase the minimum wage, the premise isn't, I mean, I get that idea, but the premise is more, that's a human being over there. You know, that's a human being who's working and they're not on assistance. They're working, and that's what we want to encourage. And so if we want to encourage working and not sitting at home on assistance or turning to a life of crime or all the other things that poor people are accused of doing, but they actually don't do it in as great of numbers as you think, they want to work, give them some money for working. That's what we want them to do. Give them enough money so that they can live in a place and have food and not have and have enough for their kids to take a class or be in an activity or something like that, just like everybody else. So that's the thinking behind minimum wage from my point of view, is that right now you got all these people and they're humans, and when they can be squeezed like the fruit pickers in John Steinbeck's novel, we're doing a great disservice to a large number of people, and we're actively harming our economy by taking people out of it. Now, in the chess match, in the big picture, I think universal income makes a lot more sense. If you want to implement it and have it implemented on a condition of either reducing or changing some aspect of minimum wage law, I think that's ultimately how you'd have to do it politically, especially if Republicans are in power. And I don't think if Democrats had all the offices, I don't know that. Point is, no, in this country right now, no one political party, no one liberal or conservative philosophy manages to keep a hold of power for very long. And it changes. And every time, when Obama won, is this the end for the Republican Party? And then when Trump wins, is this the end for the Democratic Party? No, it's not. They're going to keep lurching along back and forth just like this for the known future. But I think, what are the solutions that could actually bring a minimum wage supporter and a minimum wage opponent together, and somebody who supports free market economy versus someone who would prefer more active role for the government? Get these people together and vote for the same thing. I think universal basic income is one of the ideas I've heard of in the recent history that actually has the potential of being that. Sounds terrible. I mean, one of my conservative guys on my blog literally said it was an evil idea because it was giving money to people for not working. Now, we aren't giving them the money for not working. We're giving them the money to giving everybody the money to improve our economy. It's a grand plan to improve the economy because people will have basic living expenses, maybe not all their living expenses, but they'll have a start. So if they can only work 20 hours a week, or if they're held under 32 hours by their employer, or if they're going to school, or if whatever, they're disabled, all the different hypothetical scenarios we can come up with. Even people who are middle class who then would receive the same basic income suddenly have a savings incentive to save or invest, which again has another economic impact that is good. That's the advantage of these programs. The problem is, how do you convince people that it's not welfare? Because it's not welfare in the sense the means testing that welfare goes through, that you have to have a certain income, and if you work too much or if you have these other income sources or whatever, you can't get the welfare. And it creates this whole environment where people don't know, only certain kind of people are eligible, and it's confusing and complicated for the people who receive the assistance, for people who are understanding the issue. This would be simple. Everybody gets it, and you save or use the money for your household, for your kids, for your family. And then that frees you up to do the things we've talked about in previous segments, talking about entrepreneurship, talking about educating yourself, or being willing to work in positions that might not normally be considered enough to feed a family. It opens people up to other avenues, more worthy avenues, things that make them feel useful to the people around them. Chuck's talked about that. And that's the advantage of these programs, if they work. Now, that's the...
I do think that, just real briefly on the minimum wage, it's clear that the minimum wage does essentially displace workers with automation. And I think it's part of that bifurcating problem. It's part of that gap problem. We leave more people behind. A minimum basic income, as long as it has an incentive for work, where when people work, they're going to get ahead more, I think it does free up our economy to get what Paul Samuelson or John Maynard Keynes was after, which is, okay, at some point we're going to be so productive that we're going to have a lot more leisure time and people can choose to work, you know, smaller amounts. And I actually think that that may be one of these answers.
I'm a northern star, smitten by the southern. Keep your whiskey, Georgia, keep your peach. My Carolina is sweeter than sweet. I thought love had given up on.
It's Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio, our podcast that takes up topics that matter to those of us that live in rural Minnesota, rural northern Minnesota. It's an interesting idea they were talking about there that never really worked out as they thought. Increasing productivity would give workers more leisure time to learn and to grow their own businesses. If you appreciate these kinds of conversations, this podcast is made by Northern Community Radio, which is member-supported radio. We are independent. Become a member. KAXE.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Heidi Holton. Next, Aaron Brown of Minnesota Brown and Chuck Marone of Strong Towns continue the conversation, jobs.
Now it's a new world I see.
Well, and I want to get to your third point here that you say you're obsessed with.
It's, yeah.
You describe it as the velocity, slowing down the velocity.
When we get to small towns and we start to look at that efficiency equation, I do think that we have to, as local policymakers, become far more obsessed with slowing down the velocity of our cities and actually keeping some of that capital here. And I'll give you one example of this. Back in the 70s, we had the Minnesota Miracle here. where we went through and it's been nostalgized by the left. We're all going to pool our money together and then we'll spend that on things that are communally good. We'll have local government aid and everybody will have a fire truck and everybody will have a police force. And, you know, we should all be living this greatness because Minnesota is a great state. And I get that. Part of doing that was to go in and say to every city, you know, that little local tax you've got, you can't have that anymore. You know, that little local regulation you've got, can't have that anymore. You can't do things locally and we're going to have one state system because we're all in this together. If you are McDonald's, if you are Walmart, if you are the national corporation, that's a great deal. Because now I can go to Minnesota and every single city in the state is going to have the same local tax code, the same local zoning codes, the same structure. And I can go anywhere across the state. What it means for cities is that Hibbing has the same tax structure and Chisholm has the same tax structure as Minneapolis, as Mankato, as Duluth, as places that are vastly, vastly different from each other. I would like to see our state government actually devolve power back down to cities and allow cities, as less efficient as this would be and as messy and complex it would be, actually have their own local taxing and regulatory structures for economic reasons so that a logging community can have a very specific set of structures different than a mining community, different than a tourist community, different than a manufacturing place, because they're very, very different.
Well, it's true. I have not thought of doing that. And I tell you, my initial reaction, you know, I'm looking at the history again. That was the case earlier in state history, is everybody set their own tax system and everybody.
And it was messy and yeah. It was inefficient.
Right. And it led to some crazy stuff, like the fact that for a very brief period, the city of Hibbing had a bigger budget than the state of Delaware.
It did have crazy stuff.
Yeah, because of the mining income and the way that they taxed the mines at that time. Now, that, too, is a whole other thing. Right now, we have the taconite production tax, and it's all regulated, you know, so that there isn't one town that happens to hit the jackpot, literally, with the ore in the ground and can quickly take a hole in the mud and turn it into a fairly modern city in 20 years with theaters and opera houses and everything else. That kind of thing probably can't be replicated in our current climate. My concern, and I know this is a very hand-wringing liberal thing to say, but there would be winners and losers in that environment. And I know that the response would be, well, yes.
Yeah, we can just have, you know, our all losers today and have right. things kind of... I mean,
what happens if your city council is incompetent, though? And I don't think that's an imaginary concept for
lot
of people.
But you set up a kind of vision of the future mm-hmm. where we were going to have urban areas that worked well, tourist areas that were really expensive, and then, you know, places that were really horrible. Mm-hmm. And I'm suggesting that what we need in those places is not a state model. We actually need local innovation. And some of this stuff mm-hmm. will be crazy. Some of it we'll look at and go, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Some city councils will be incompetent and do really dumb things, but some places are going to do really well. And we can learn from them and I think help these cities
do better. Say this. One thing I really want to see is local governments and local communities thinking for themselves a little bit more. That might be a way to generate that. The idea that you have a local government that can make a decision that's public and thoughtful and then be held accountable for it. You know, right now, you can not only have an incompetent city council, but they could stay in office forever because basically all that stuff is done for them. The tax codes, as long as they try not to screw up, they're fine. People like them. They're at the bar. They're nice guys. You know, so maybe that's the way to kind of turn over some of these leadership in some of these towns is to get them moving on. I don't know that I'm totally on board yet, Chuck, but it's a really thoughtful idea.
Well, I want to end with a quote from a guy you might know, Minnesota Brown.
Who?
He wrote on his blog post, "Here on the Iron Range, we possess the opportunity to not only save ourselves, but to become a proving ground for new ideas."
Yeah, and that's what I want. And I think...
Wow, that sounds like an endorsement of my approach.
Well, it's being taken over by other political forces. But, you know, I think that is the goal, however we get there, that our community, the city of X, Y, or Z, is out there like, what are we going to do to fight for our future? I think that's what needs to happen throughout northern Minnesota, throughout all of rural America. And that's what you need, because honestly, we're showing that state governments, the federal government, and big business alike aren't necessarily going to be there to save us. I just don't see that happening.
Do you appreciate Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio with Aaron Brown and Chuck Marone? It's a liberal and a conservative talking about issues, but more importantly, listening to each other. You can show us your appreciation by becoming a member now. It's member-supported radio. Individuals matter. When we show other organizations that we have people who stand behind us, who appreciate the way that we bring radio to northern Minnesota, it makes all the difference. Become a member, 800-662-5799. Dig deep, giving context with the past and looking ahead to the future. Now it's a new world I see. Music by Seth Glier on this edition of Dig Deep. We want to hear from you. Do you have a topic you think Aaron and Chuck should take up? You can send us an email, comments@kaxe.org. Don't forget, we're member-supported radio producing this podcast. For $10 a month, we'll get you a brand new tote bag or a mug. Go to kaxe.org to pledge your support now. On the next installment of Dig Deep, we take up the topic of healthcare.